Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that gives us an opportunity to meet people who make a difference in our communities and in our lives. Today, our guest is Rudy Pizzotti, Distinguished Professor Emeritus at Indiana University, artist, printmaker, entrepreneur, and Renaissance person. For the next hour or so, we'll ask him a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Rudy, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
We're delighted to have you here. Now, let me introduce you to our listeners by mentioning some of your accomplishments. When Rudy came to IU, he inherited broken-down presses and a battalion of termites. But Rudy had dreams, and he built a printmaking program that was one of the finest in the country. Along the way, he has received numerous awards, grants, and commissions. He has been an artist in residence in the U.S. and Israel, has had one-person exhibits all over the world, and his works are collected in numerous public and private collections. Rudy, you were born in Telluride, Colorado, which even today has a population of only about 1,500 people. Let's start there. How did you get there, and how did you get out of there?
Well, my mother and father came there at different times. My mother was 13. My father about 19 or 20, and they lived 10 miles apart in Italy and didn't know each other, but came over here. My mother came to help an uncle who had a large boarding house and had many minors to take care of, etc. And they met, fell in love, got married, and I'm the product of that marriage. I was an only child and stayed there until I was five, and then we moved to Silverton, Colorado, which was just over the mountains. And I stayed in Silverton until I finished high school and then went to University of Colorado on a scholarship and stayed there 1 year. And then Uncle Sam called, and I was drafted for military service. And I spent 3 years in the field artillery unit. 18 months of that was overseas, 9 months of it in combat with a man named George Patton and 7th Army, and was in on the tail end of the Battle of the Bulge. Came back from the service, married my high school sweetheart, Dorothy. After a couple of months in Silverton, went on to Colorado again and finished both my degrees.
Okay, from Colorado, then how did you get to Bloomington?
Well, from Colorado, in August when I got my last degree, my master's degree, Dottie says, "Where do we go now?" And I said, at the moment, I had no idea. But fortunately, I'd met a graduate student who came from the University of Nebraska to do his work at Colorado. And he said, "I think they need somebody there to teach painting and printmaking." So I gave them a call. They invited me to come out and look at it, and they hired me.
So now you're in Nebraska.
I was there for 2 years, and then I was fortunate enough to get a Fulbright, and I went to Italy for a year. Came back and stayed 2 more years, and then in the spring of 1956, I was invited to come to Indiana for an interview. Henry Hope, who was then chairman, hired me. So I came here in the summer of 56.
And you've been here ever since?
Yes.
I want to step back, because when we talked before, you mentioned the military and how important it was to you.
Yes.
Could you touch on that a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to, because I think it's had a big effect on all the rest of my life. First of all, the discipline and physical training and so forth that was involved, the camaraderie, the gathering of thousands of men and women from all parts of the world, or all parts of this country at least while we were still in the States, people from different ethnic, different cultures, and I learned a great deal from them and got a sense about life at a very early age, because I was only 18 when I went into service. But when we came out, I think there was another aspect about the GIs that suddenly at the end of the war flooded all of the college campuses and university campuses. And in at least at Colorado, we were called DARs, the damned average raisers. And I think that was because we were there for a purpose. We felt older, that we were far behind times. And I think we began our lives as professionals on a much different level than I have seen it in some of the students that I have dealt with.
Well, was this the experience of being in combat or in war, such a life-expanding experience?
Sure. It's, of course, you know, we also spoke of the idea of immortality, the fact that when you're young, you feel there's just nothing that can deter you. But those were extraordinary times, the idea of going halfway across the world to fight in some kind of battle that, you know, I mean, we all believed in it. It was, I guess, in the when you look at the history of recent encounters that this country has had, it was probably one of the most justified. But I think it gave us a sense of involvement and certain risk factors that were involved, that when we came back home and went to a university, there wasn't anything they could throw at us that was on the level of what we had already sustained.
You mentioned about changing some of the rules at a school.
Yes. Well, creativity at that time, the year that I put in before I went to service, everything closed at 5 o'clock. All the buildings were closed. The certainly the women had a dress code, no matter what they did. If they were pouring bronze or making a huge pot, God knows what, they still had to wear dresses. When we came back, we changed all of that. Some of it was done by force. I think I related to you the incident when we first got into the studios at the university in the art department by jimmying the locks and the windows and being caught by the janitors and still not deterred, being brought in front of the chairman. And I was a part of that group. And we simply told the chairman that nothing was going to keep us out of there, that creativity did not stop at 5 o'clock in the evening. So in a sense, I think that opened the doors. And from that point on, the involvement, at least in the art department, was a round-the-clock endeavor.
And that's become sort of a standard.
Oh, that I think that's all accepted now. What, 50 years have gone by since then, and I don't think they're going to stop and ask who made all of this possible. But I think it was the maturity, the sense of responsibility that these GIs had, and their purpose, their aim, what they wanted to do.
You had an interesting experience on a trip to Russia. Could you relate that to us?
Yes. Well, in 1961, I was selected by the State Department along with Jimmy Ernst, and he and I were the only two American artists that were okayed by the Russian desk to visit, and we got over there. We were there for a little over 2 months. Over 25,000 miles we traveled through the Soviet Union. We gave lectures which were interpreted. We showed slides of art that I'm sure infuriated the Russian people who were in charge of our tour. And during our stay there, there were two incidents, world incidents. One was the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the other one was the orbiting of the Earth by Yuri Gagarin. And we were present at both of those events. During the Bay of Pigs invasion, we were sequestered in the American Embassy in Moscow, and the outside of the building was totally trashed. They cut all the phone lines, any line of communication, pelted the buildings with cans of paint and ink. And the people inside the embassy were staying in communication by using the old crank field phones that we had in training during the Army.
That must have been a little bit frightening.
Yeah, it was long way from home.
And no escape route.
And no escape route.
Let's go back to the early years. When did the seeds of being an artist get started?
Well, I always look back at about ages 6 and 7 when I began to draw. And I drew everything that was in front of me. Started with the cartoons, naturally. And then any books that had illustrations, school books, etc., I began to draw. And my mother, who probably didn't have more than a 5th or 6th grade education before she came to the States, had a great sensitivity and probably saw, I hope, the beginnings of some kind of ability. And she made an effort to at least give me the supplies and materials that I needed to keep this going.
So you just started doing it.
Yes.
You're self-taught until
right.
you went to school.
There were no Saturday art classes, certainly no art classes in the school, even in high school. So as a matter of my own desire and something that I just had to do. And then, of course, in school, I was asked to illustrate the yearbooks and to do things on the blackboard for certain festivities of the year, Thanksgiving, Christmas, etc.
So you became the school artist.
I was the school artist, yes.
So your parents and your teachers nurtured this kid.
Yes, yes.
Now, what about mentors or instructors?
Well, I had some great people at the University of Colorado. In fact, the chairman of the department was a woman. Muriel Cybele Wally was her name. And she was a great supporter, not only of myself, but all of the young people that had come back from service. And there were 4 or 5 other women on the faculty that were really very, very good artists and tremendously good teachers. But Colorado had another thing that was so vital, and that is they had an exceptional visiting artist program. An alumni had given them a wonderful grant and expressed the idea that only the very best artists would be brought in as visiting artists to teach the young aspiring students. And in the last 2 years of my work there, in the summer of 1949, I had the great honor and pleasure to work with Max Beckmann, who's one of the greats of German Expressionist, a man who was derided by Hitler. He was placed in a category of degenerate artist, and he was exiled from his home in Germany. And I spent the summer with him. It was an incredible experience. The critiques were like psychoanalysis. Unbelievable questions. Who do you read? What composers do you listen to? You have an Italian name. Do you speak Italian? Do you understand the language? He even questioned our authority in terms of the subjects we chose to depict in our work. Often would ask us, did we have the knowledge to really deal with that subject? Were we mature enough to try to deal with what this was all about? And then the following summer, I had the pleasure of working with Ben Shawn, who's considered as one of America's really great artists. And he died in 1968, I believe. But from the day I met him in 1950 in August, it was actually June through August, I stayed fairly close to him, both through letters and through telephone conversations. Very demanding, was very interested in what we were as individuals, interested in our political ideas, how we thought about various issues that faced the United States at the time. He just insisted that we always keep in mind that we had a very deep responsibility as artists. And I think I took away from those two men a certain charge that has stayed with me till this time, and hopefully for some more years to come.
I think it's interesting that one of the pieces you selected to play, and I think now's a great time, was called In Praise of Sean.
Yes.
And it's by William Schumann with the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein.
Yes.
We have just heard an excerpt from In Praise of Sean by William Schumann, as played by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein, a piece written in honor of Ben Sean, one of the instructors of our guest today, Rudy Pizzotti, artist, printmaker, and distinguished professor emeritus of Indiana University. You mentioned something, Rudy, just before we had the break for the music, about both of these mentors mentioning the importance of being more than just an artist. Right. And I think you would call that the bistro school or something.
Yes.
Could you sort of explain that and the importance of a wider view?
I'd be happy to. I think it was certainly demonstrated in both of these individuals. They were well-read. They knew music. They were friends of artists and poets. They had traveled. They had sensitivities about other cultures, and they kept telling us how big the world was, how much there was out there for all of us to get a hold of, and that there was enough there that would satisfy each of our unique needs, because they also kept that in our minds, that we were unique individuals, that we weren't all going to paint the same thing or be interested in the same thing. And I think I took a lot away from that. I certainly brought it to Indiana University when I came here. And I tried to infiltrate our program with some of those ideas. I always thought the students had to take as great advantage of the university as they possibly could. Now, when I brought another person here to work with me, it was Marvin Lowe. I had met him in Italy in the summer of 67, and Marvin, who had been a graduate of Juilliard and also of Brooklyn College, a great musician, tenor sax man, well-read, this was the kind of person that I thought would emphasize the very things that I had brought here with me, and we certainly have done that. And I think Wendy Kalman, who joined us in 76, has done exactly the same thing. All the selections, or most of the selections we made in terms of our advanced and graduate students, were made with those things in mind. And we constantly tried to influence those students to broaden themselves as much as possible while they were in the confines of the university.
In other words, to go back to what was happening in the 20s in Paris was
right.
To sit around the table with not only artists, but composers, playwrights.
Stage designers, ballet people, musicians, book designers, and so forth. I think that really exemplified what made those people as great as they were, because they had so much to draw from.
Do you feel that that's missing from the present educational programs?
Yeah, I think they get a little myopic, and there's a sense about time, the idea of getting in school, getting that degree, and getting out. And that bothers me a bit. Now, I realize there's money involved and expenses. The tuition in schools has increased, and there are a lot of deterrents in a way, but there are so many magnificent things to be gotten in a university, and I think, unfortunately, some of them miss it.
In my introduction, I mentioned the termites. Can
yes.
you talk about Mitchell Hall?
Yes, Mitchell Hall, you know, God love it. It was a landmark. Many people loved it and fought for its existence. But in terms of what it offered for people who were interested in creative activity, and in some cases where good equipment and air conditioning and so forth was very, very important, it was not the best place to work. And the first few years I was here, I mentioned the termites. In the spring when they came out, they covered everything. We had baths of water out to soak paper that would just be absolutely covered with these termites. So we were very happy when we finally left Mitchell Hall in 1961 to come to the present new building.
Tell us about the areas of art that you call your disciplines.
Well, I started at Colorado with a lot of painting. And when Colorado began developing a printmaking program, Wendell Black came there, who was in the first class that worked with Mauricio Lisansky at the University of Iowa, which today is still considered one of the centers for printmaking in this country. And Wendell Black established a wonderful program in printmaking, and I gravitated to printmaking as a natural because I love drawing. And drawing was a very, very strong and important discipline that was part of everybody's training in those days. I don't know how much of it is still as emphasized as it used to be, but for us, it was an important element in the curriculum. So printmaking was important. And so I was involved in painting, both in oils and watercolors, in printmaking, the various media. I didn't do any sculpture at that time, but later, after trips to Italy and living and working there, I began working in bronzes, and I've done some wood carving. So in my own time, I've covered a rather wide expanse of the media.
You mentioned about not conducive to good prints, and yet you are the inspiration behind Echo Press,
yes.
which was one of the great printmaking organizations in the country.
Yes.
Can you share your thoughts?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The press was started, co-directed, actually, David Keister, who was a graduate student at IU, and my personal assistant and I were the co-founders. David, before coming to IU, had printed for 5 or 6 years at Landfall Press in Chicago. And he had printed for most of the major people in this country. So he came to us with incredible amount of experience. And towards the end of his tenure here as a graduate student, he said, "Do you think there's any possibility that we might start a press here?" And I said, "Well, I think the two of us might be able to do it." He said, "Well, I'll be happy to be the master printer and run the shop, but you've got to look for the money and all the other things." So I started with the IU Foundation and Bill Armstrong, who was alive then and director. And Bill was so kind. I kiddingly said to Bill many times later that I don't know that he had a real idea of what we wanted to do, but he was very benevolent and understanding and offered to help us. So through the aegis of the IU Foundation, we put Echo Press on the map. And within 5 or 6 years, we had our foot in the door, and it wasn't long after that. By the time our 10th anniversary came here, which was earmarked by a wonderful exhibition at the IU Museum, I think we were considered as one of the best presses in the country. Now, I had a great staff here, Pegram Harrison, who was the business manager, and David Keister, Master Printer, and David Calkins. They're still around, good friends, and it was through their enormous energy and their dedication to that institution that Echo did the things that it did.
Well, you got recognition around the country from people on
that. Oh, yes, yes. We were, I think, well-respected. I think many people said many times how wonderfully executed the work was and that we picked very, very good artists. Now, we took some chances there because some of the artists were not necessarily totally established, but they were what we called emerging artists. And I think Pegram and David, who made most of the selections, picked some very, very important people who proved later on in their careers that we made the right choices. And what? Echo went on, and I think it ran into a few deterrents in the early 90s when everybody in the country, even major galleries and major print shops, suffered immensely from a huge drop in art sales. And I think the powers to be at Indiana thought that maybe this was going to be a general tendency. And so by the end of June in 1995, the decision had been made to terminate Echo Press, which was a terrible disappointment to me. I have to say probably it's the biggest disappointment I have had in being at IU. There were wonderful experiences, and I think that the students that had helped and all the other factors that became a very positive part of Echo could have continued to help. And I think we could have made our way, and maybe we could have convinced some donors to put some backing behind us. But those things are gone, and we have to move on.
Well, your skills as an artist have taken you all over the world. Can you just share an adventure or two about that? We've heard about Russia now.
Yes. Well, I had a wonderful experience to go to Yugoslavia, to Belgrade, and they had an international conference there in 1965. And they had a three-month span, and they invited six artists from the United States to be a part of that. So I was one of those six artists. I spent a month and a half there working with Claire Romano and John Ross. I made 13 prints in that month and a half. We worked roughly in front of about 465,000 people that came to the U.S. Pavilion. Now, I don't like to throw numbers around like that to say that because it's a large number, it was important. But I think what we were able to do in front of all these people to produce prints and to show them how all of this mechanism works was quite an outstanding performance. We only got one day a week off on Sundays, so it was not an easy thing. I had a wonderful stint in Hawaii. I was invited to be artist in residence there for 6 months at the Academy. And I think probably one of the greatest things that came out of there was a new sense and craving for color, mostly through the vegetation, the beautiful flowers that I saw, the water, the fish, and just the general environment of Hawaii was very stimulating.
Of course, you always came home to the New World.
Right.
This is the segue to the New World Symphony, excerpts from that with George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra.
Thank you.
We have just heard a selection from the New World Symphony by Dvorak, played by the Cleveland Orchestra, conducted by George Zell. A selection of our guest today, Rudy Pizzotti, artist and master printmaker. Rudy, with an Italian name, you've had to go to Italy.
Yes. I was born of Italian parents. First language I learned and recorded was Italian. For years growing up, while my parents were still alive and many of their friends, I had to use both the English and the Italian. And when I met Ben Shahn at Colorado, he, towards the end of our stay there, said, "You've got to get to Italy." And I said, "Well, how am I going to get to Italy?" He said, "By Fulbright." And Fulbright grants were just being issued by the federal government. So he said, "I'd be happy to recommend you for it, but I must tell you that not a single person that I've recommended has received one yet." But I did. I applied, and I got to Italy in 1952. And it was an incredible experience. When I first landed in Italy, I thanked my parents for the language and the sense of the culture, because I understood what was going on, and it was so important. I went to visit relatives during the Easter vacation, and it was just an unbelievable experience to stand in the midst of these people that had been, to me at that time, just names. And, of course, it started a love affair with Italy that has remained until this very day. I've been back, went back for another year on a Guggenheim in 63, and I've taught there on three different occasions for summer stints. And then I've taken some groups back for the Alumni Association. So there's a really deep love affair with Italy.
It's nice to feel the roots, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is.
Through all these adventures, your family has been with you. Can you tell us about your wife and children?
I'd be happy to. They are a very important element in my life. My wife, Dorothy, we were married in 1946 when I got back, and she has been an incredible supporter of my activities. And through her unselfishness, I've been able to do a lot of things that other people would not have been able to do. She never once stood in my way to follow some of these possibilities that came to me, to leave not only the university and the city and the state of Indiana, but oftentimes being even outside the country. So I owe a deep debt of gratitude to Dottie for all of that work and that support. She's been my tax person, took care of all my records, and I jokingly say has kept me out of jail all these years in terms of reporting taxes and so forth. We have five children. The oldest, Valerie, married and living in Portland, Oregon, or Lake Oswego. They have one daughter, Jocelyn, who's just graduated from college, son who's a molecular biologist. He works at National Institute of Health and involved in cancer research and also in the genome now. Married to Mary, who also a molecular biologist. Two granddaughters, Rachel and Anna. And then next in line is Gina, who's involved with guidance and counseling in Scottsdale, Arizona, just married. And then a younger daughter, Mia, who got her graduate degree in landscape architecture at Georgia and is a member of the landscape architecture team here at IU. I'm married to Tom Williams and two step granddaughters, and Jamie and Megan. And then the youngest is Ilika, who got a BFA from Indiana in graphic design and is currently in New York on some interviews for possibly a job. So big family, all creative, good people. They're out doing their part in the world, and they've been a really important aspect of my life.
I think you ought to mention that Dorothy has made your front yard look like something off the cover of House Beautiful.
Well, she has done an incredible job with the landscaping all around the house. She has made our place a beautiful place to live.
If someone wanted to see some of your art on display in the South Central Indiana area, where would they go?
Well, the best place would be the gallery. I've been with Rosemary Frazier now for, I think, 32 years. The last birthday was 32 years of celebration. She has a fairly good inventory of my work. I have some work also currently at the Idle George Museum. It's an exhibition dedicated to Western landscape. And since I've lived and worked in New Mexico and Arizona and Colorado, I have a lot of work that deals with that subject. So there's work there. There's work also at the Indianapolis Museum in their permanent collection as well as in their sales and rental gallery. And I have some work in Chicago.
You also have a retrospective coming up.
Yes. In March of 2002, Heidi Gelt has been kind enough to offer me a retrospective, and I'm working with Nan Brewer and Linda Baden in trying to work out all the logistics, which are many. But I'm looking forward very much to that because Bloomington is the place that I have spent a great deal of my time. We've lived here longer than any other place, and it'll be a pleasure and an honor to get this work out on the walls and see what friends and interested people will have to say about it.
What are the gifts that you have received in your life that you would want to pass on?
First of all, good family, a loving understanding about what people are when they're children, how they grow up, what their needs are, that they have to have love and direction. I've had very good education, simple high school in a sense, but very bright and dedicated teachers that got into things that I thought were very, very important and proved to be so when I got to a higher level in college and university. I had good faculty on the undergraduate and graduate level, and a lot of people that have helped since I left school and started. You know, Herman Wells, God love him, said he was lucky in life, and I think I have to express that too. I think I was lucky. I've also been told on more than one occasion that luck is involved, but you also have to be prepared when luck does open its arms to you. So I hope that I've worked and put together things that have made me ready when luck chose to appear.
You mentioned that the teachers and instructors and the people you've lived with have given you some important things. Could you explain what you mean by those?
Well, the importance, I've sat in the presence of some very important people. I spent a week with Max Ernst, who, you know, the history books will tell you is one of the major people in 20th century painting. Had a wonderful day with Henry Moore when Albert Elson, who was a faculty member here, was doing an article on him in London, and I happened to be visiting. These people, and I should mention Sean and Beckman again, these people with all their abilities, their knowledge, etc., were still human beings. They had compassion, they had emotion, and they had drive and sensitivity, and they were always open to something else that could happen. I've never been very involved with ego and self-importance. I think I'll leave that up to somebody else to decide what I've done and what the merits are. But I think Indiana University has been a wonderful place to be in that regard, because through the people that I've met here, through what they've explained about their own interests and ideas, has also been given me an opportunity to expand my own mind and my own feelings.
What are the qualities that you look for in a budding artist?
Well, I think the important part is, I think my colleague Marvin Lowe expressed this very well, as fire in the belly. You can tell, no matter how young they are, if they really have that desire. And the next thing is uniqueness. I think the fact that you see in them and that they sense what they have that is different and more important than anything else that others may have. And then, of course, to be able to extend them and to get as much out of what they're involved in as possible. And to take chances. I don't think you're going to get anywhere unless you take some risks and dare yourself to do something.
And to go beyond the walls.
Yes.
What a great way to end. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. But the neat thing is that one of your selections was In the Mood by Glenn Miller, which we will play as we end, because we want people to be in the mood to be creative.
Wonderful.
You have been listening to Profiles, where we meet the person behind the persona. Our guest today has been Rudy Pozzati, artist, printmaker, entrepreneur, Renaissance person, and distinguished professor emeritus at Indiana University. Rudy, we appreciate your spending the time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was produced in the studios of WFIU in July of 2000. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Pascash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.